Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
So
my idea here was to share a little bit of an action scene from this book I just torturously finished writing. And
it's not a book.
It is not. What's that?
Tab, it's not a book.
My dad's not a cell phone. Does anybody know that? Throw it to the ground. Two of the people in the room have actually read advanced reader copies of the book, so I'm thankful that you wanted to hear my voice. Because apparently that's why you're here. And then I thought we could just have a conversation afterwards about cyberpunk gaming in general, because there are definitely challenges and differences for science fiction gaming and cyberpunk gaming that are not endemic to fantasy gaming. So every chapter of the book opens up with either a encyclopedia entry or a an advertisement in some cases, or a quotation. Mostly that's a way to handle exposition. But in this particular case, it's an advertisement for the Black Knight Industries Shredder Machine Pistol, which is an Interface Zero weapon. And I will start simply by saying, when I went to do this, I said, let me go look and find old 1920s and 30s Thompson submachine gun ads, because he used to advertise those in the New York Times. Like, get your Thompson submachine gun. So this little advertisement piece is copied almost word for word, except changing it for cyberpunk, obviously, from a 1920s and 1930s Thompson submachine gun ad, for two of them, actually. So this opens up with an advertisement. Better shoot a shredder. The Black Knight Industries Shredder Machine Pistol, sold only to those on the side of law and order. Here's the gun pirates of the space lanes fear most. Be ready for any emergency. It's the safest gun to shoot in a vacuum, because its ceramic rounds do not fly wild. Like I said, this is almost line for line from a 1930s Thompson submachine gun ad. Extraordinary accuracy, lightweight rounds, spacecraft-safe ammunition. Prepare to repel borders. The Shredder MP has quickly become one of our most popular personal defense weapons, specifically designed for use with ceramic rounds. Both its high rate of fire and unique single-shot setting place the Shredder MP among our most versatile weapons. Highly adaptable and easily expanded to accommodate a wide range of tap, aim, and targeting assistant, ta-ta, systems, the Black Knight Shredder's adaptability, expandability, and system-renowned dependability are sure to please the most weapons-avid gearhead, secmen, or ship's crew. Anyone on your force who can shoot a shredder better. It's the gun that safeguards innocent bystanders by never puncturing your hull. Shoot at those pirates, and on high burst, you get them all. This is why pirates surrender to defenders armed with the Black Knight Shredder MP. There's no retreat from a shredder. The most effective portable firearm in existence for repelling pirates, disciplining crew, corporate industrial plants, spaceports, and population centers. So the 1920s and 30s Thompson ads actually said that our high rate of fire will send criminals running, that they're safe to use in population centers. Like, these were the advertising pluses of the Thompson submachine gun. So I just thought that was absolutely hilarious, right? There was a little piece more to this. The government and, what happened here? My page is just finished. There we go. Government and Kongom tested, now ready for personal protective purposes. Remember, Shredder is better, so better shoot a Shredder. Tap the code BetterShredder to blacknightkongom.net/sale and secure your 20% discount on top of the line personal security today. So, the world of Interface Zero and the world of Gunmetal Games expansions there is a very typical Gibsonian world, right? We have the tap, which he calls the tendril access processor, and it's basically your direct neural interlink. It does not, however, allow virtual reality. It allows only augmented reality. So, for example, there's a scene where the hero is trying to get into work. He writes some code for his tap. It connects to the employee HR manual, and it codes everyone he sees by outlining them in a vibrant color, depending on how much higher or lower up the corporate chain they are from him. So he knows whether it's safe to shove them the fuck out of the way as he runs to the elevator, right? So you can overlay reality, but you it's really hard to replace it, right? And that's called the tap. So I'm this particular scene I'm going to share with you, our hero and his lady love have just been cornered and traced. And there's a piece of military tech in his head that the bad guys are after. He doesn't quite know what that tech is or how it works yet. He's just starting to get a handle on it. The two of them have just had a rapprochement. They had been at odds. And this is the scene. So the main character's name is Derek. And the secondary character is Natasha, or Nat, as he calls her. Nat, move, they're on to us. To her credit, Natasha, I should know her real name, damn it, didn't ask any questions. She's crammed stuff into her bag. Squeezing into the hallway, we banged shoulders and paused on sticker cells, which is why the slugs tore up the exit and not our heads. Splinters flew. The door ripped open and off its hinges, flying end over end into the hall with a clatter. Something moved my body. I don't know another way to explain. I was no longer at the helm. My heart rate skyrocketed, banging my ribs like a fat, panicked rat. Thrum, pat, 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 thrum, thrum, pat, pat, pat. On its own, my arm whipped out and grabbed Natasha. Then my body threw itself backwards and down next to the bed. None of this was my doing. Another burst sheared the air where we just stood and sliced the mattress. The bedding puffed with each hit and floated through the room like a dandelion storm. Derek, that's smart ammo. I stared at her. Those shots, they made a left turn to hit the bed. If we don't move, we're dead. I stood. Only I didn't. I did everything you do inside your head to stand, but my mind didn't connect to my legs. Abruptly, I was a passenger. Instead of standing, my eyes locked on the door to the bathroom hall, and my body crawled toward it. Don't leave me! I'd left her backed against the wall to the left of the doorless exit, covered in splinters and dust, terrified. Oh my God. I struggled to go back, but not even my head turned. Why couldn't I look? Why was I crawling away? Turn around! Turn! Around basic things, we don't normally hear our thoughts. No one hears extend hand, place fingers, squeeze, and lift to mouth when drinking coffee. We want coffee, we pick it up, we drink it. Thought yields action. Commonplace, unremarkable, except it is remarkable. The unconscious command of our own bodies is our one godlike power. We take that simple equation, thought yields action, for granted until we try to program the hundreds of instructions it takes a Bioroid to lift a cup, or until tragedy strikes. We don't fear loss. We fear impotence born of it. Uncomfortable talking to a soldier who lost an arm? It's not the missing arm that's disturbing you. Accidents happen. The war hero chats away unbowed. It's not empathy that makes us queasy, not quite. Their damaged body compels us to imagine suffering the same. True, but we fear we couldn't handle that incapacity. We fear the helplessness, and confronted even with a whiff, we are shaken. On the floor of that crappy hotel, I didn't lose a hand. I lost my entire body. From 1 second to the next, every inch of me stolen. I heard all my micro thoughts, like a running commentary of instructions. The tinny words, stop, gather weight, extend legs, stand, spun through my head like ball bearings circling a bowl, and I didn't stand. I panicked. Gibbering terror consumed me. I could neither cry out nor weep any more than an insect can open a door. Don't leave me, Natasha, shit, he yelled. Fuck, 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 fuck. I threw every- oh, by the way, I'm okay. Fuck, 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 fuck. I knew everything. I threw everything at the wall between my thoughts and my body. I turned my hysteria on it. I clawed and I howled and I fought for control. It worked, but only a little. Instead of resuming my rightful place in the driver's seat of myself, I fought my body to a standstill. I flopped in place like a dying fish, but we stopped crawling. My nose smacked off the baseboard of the bed. I bit my lip, bled blood I couldn't afford to lose. Natasha snapped in, oh, he's wounded at this point, that's why. Natasha snapped into motion. She belly crawled to me, grabbed my shoulders, and tried to stop my flailing. More whatever they were, into the furniture. A particularly angled convulsion slapped my head into her nose with a crack. Ah, shit! She dropped me, and I bounced my head off the floor. I blacked out, only for a few seconds. Natasha's open palm slap popped my eyes open wide. She knelt on my shoulder, arm cocked back like an avenging Valkyrie, walls and ceiling shredding behind her, and belted me again. Don't you die on me! She drew back for another crack. She was exposed. I imagined a bullet exploding through her head. And my body stopped fighting. It grabbed her, pulled her down nose to nose, then flipped me onto my belly, leaving Natasha face down on my back, like pulling a tablecloth off without breaking the dishes. With her as a passenger, I resumed crawling toward the opposite hallway. More shots splintered the wall above us, and Natasha dug her chin into the crook of my neck, praying. I didn't know she was religious. We scuttled into the hall and shut the door behind us. A short jog left, and it dead-ended in a bathroom. Data inundated my tap. Bewildering diagrams, icons, calculations too complex to follow. A violence of translucent colors. I spotted a blueprint of the plumbing, gone at the speed of thought. None of it made sense. The information cascaded so thickly, it sealed away the outside world, blinding me. Too much, too fast. Hot, white like phosphorus. Ah! Natasha said something. I felt her breath. It was like shooting fireworks into the sun. I was the sun. I was consumed by burn. She was another piece of heat. One more moment of irrelevant data fuel. I screamed while we crawled to the bathroom. Natasha grabbed a fistful of my hair and jerked my head to the side. She peered inside my incinerator headcage with brobdingnagian eyes. My body ignored her and kept scuttling toward the bathroom like an alligator. I couldn't respond, no matter how I tried. I quailed before a firestorm of information. It commanded my silence. It was too strong. It was commands. Of course. How obvious. Whatever commanded me was code. This was a program. The realization alone weakened its hold. The information burn slowed, dulled to a background roar. I could see and hear again. Natasha clung to me, her belly warm on my back, and punched the back of my head weakly. It ached like hell. And I'd check for a concussion later, if we lived that long. We had nearly reached the bathroom. I still wasn't in control, but I had regained awareness. I could speak after a fashion. Not by controlling my mouth, but by passing my thoughts to the tapplication governing my body. It passed my words onto throat and lips, and this extra step created an odd delay. "What's wrong with you?" she said. "Look at me." Natasha rabbit punched the base of my skull again hard, trying to get my attention. I saw stars. On its own, my head turned her way. She finally had the program's attention. It skinned her tear-streaked face green, then red. It couldn't make up its mind. Green, red, green, red, 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 red. We stopped crawling. Threat identified. No, green! She's green, damn it! Acknowledged, Commander Talbot. Updating provisional status. His name is Derek Talbot. Inside my head, I heard, "Now, stop fighting me, you idiot. Sir idiot." To Natasha, my mouth said, "Comply with movement to maximize survival, ally status provisional." With an audible click, Natasha flashed green, then faded to normal. My head swiveled itself forward, and we lurched into motion, finally reaching the bathroom door. Inside my head, I fell to my knees in relief. Wait, provisional? Why do you sound like that fucking taxicab? She whispered the question close to my ear, breath warm against my cheek. I said to my body, "Inhale, please." It complied. The mere scent of her calmed me. even slithering through spent bullets and shattered plastic, gunfire raging around us, death descending. Provisional ally is useful, but this is better. And a warm calm descended. Derek, answer me. Please, you're freaking me out. What an ass I was, calmly taking solace while she clung, terrified, to my back. Why wasn't I freaking out? I checked my med reg. It was piping drugs so hard my veins had to hold more drugs than blood. I recognized none of them. And I thought, eh, so what? Even in my doped up state, that sounded like an attitude that could get us killed. No, you drugged and calm is better. I've got this. Who the hell are you? Derek, Natasha thumped my shoulder, tears straining her voice. For the last time, answer me. I passed a message to my mouth. The TAP. The survival program, I think. I'm not in charge. It's running my body. A transom window in the hall above us exploded. My arms covered my head. Shattered glass spanged off the walls and floor. A meaty fist jammed through the broken glass and angled a sleek, palm-sized gun at us. Blue actinic fire lit the barrel tip like a torch. The weapon was fused to its owner's wrist with flat black tubes that entered the flesh like glistening tapeworms. The gum hummed death. That's cool. Cool. The voice in my head thought this was cool? It's terrifying. Despite the drugs, adrenaline hit like fuel on a fire, and my body jolted into action. I bunched my legs against the wall, catapulted us both off a nearby wall, and with a click and a whine, the killer's gun illumined the hall in blue fluorescence, and then explosions chewed up the floor behind us like an invisible saw closing fast. We crashed through the bathroom door, and the top of my head cracked against the toilet. Another toilet. There's a scene with a toilet. Pain shot down my spine. No time to register the damage. My body flipped over, dumped Natasha, and my foot slammed the door shut. Not that a bathroom door was going to stop that weapon. Before it closed, I glimpsed a man in a gray suit wrench himself through the thin, shattered window like a contortionist. He shoved through an inch at a time at inhuman angles, and then plopped to the floor in a pile of disjointed limbs. The pile quivered, stirred, and unfolded upward, gun out. The bathroom door slammed shut, snapping off my view of the assassin, and nausea hit like a tidal wave. I heaved into my mouth. No, I swallowed the vial down. No way. No. As abruptly as it struck, the sickness passed. My body crouched, eyes fixed on the door, and Natasha clasped in front of me. I tried to put her behind me, but nothing worked. I was forced to hold her, the woman I loved, like a human shield. With a mental click I hadn't initiated, rainbow blobs covered the world. Out in the hall, through the closed door, I watched a multicolored, glowing form flatten itself against one wall. Had to be the gunman. I couldn't decode the image. No matter how I squinted, throbbing hues blobbed around, dissolving into each other. Distantly, I heard yelling. Glowy the Blobular Assassin inched toward our hiding place. It held a dark, colorless block at waist level. Must be the gun. That thing chewed through ceramicrete walls. That thing chewed through ceramicrete walls. It had vaporized flesh and bone. I shuddered. I'm going to be murdered by rainbow jelly carrying a shoebox. I couldn't decide whether to laugh or cry. Either one is fine, just stop thinking so loudly. The killer stopped short of the bathroom. The black box pointed straight at us. My body tensed. To my x-ray vision, or whatever this was, the entire gun shifted from charcoal to white hot. The program in charge slammed me to the right and stuffed us both between the toilet and the wall. Something in my back popped. A vertebra. It broke my spine. Shut up. A pillow-sized sandstorm, shaped like a teardrop, blew through the door at waist height, slightly to the left of center, exactly where we'd been seconds before, and it pulverized the wall behind the bowl. Natasha cried out. Debris clouded the room in a haze. One moment the door was solid, the next, perforated by a gazillion ceramic needles in a 2-foot circle. Microshards of sheared glass rained down. Their heat sparked the dust to pinprick flame before ting-tinging off the ceramic floor. I screamed, "What is that thing?" Natasha said, "Some kind of flechette pistol, probably a Shredder MP, but not like any I've shot." My body shot her a look over my shoulder. "What? I like guns. Sue me." Provisional ally Natasha is accurate and also cool. Enemy ordnance is a modified wetling self-arming BKI Shredder Machine Pistol Mark II, or SMP, not yet available on the general market. Lack of hyper-object control in this model eliminates the prime vulnerability of Tata systems. Sweet. Great. 2 gun nuts. And I think I'll stop there. Gives us a taste of what the... And that's a half an hour if you have to listen to. So that's a scene from the book. This is connected.
This is probably
And like I said earlier, I thought it would be fun just to sit around and talk about the difference between cyberpunk gaming and fantasy gaming. You are Jeff?
Yep, Jeff. Sorry I was late, but I was just finishing up an Interface Zero game, and they had this on the book before I get out.
Oh, nice. Nice. Were you running it?
Yeah.
Oh, so you're the fellow that I was talking to online.
That's me. Gotcha.
So, do you run any cyberpunk games? You work on cyberpunk, right?
Yep. Hypercore 2099.
Right.
And part of the cool thing is that it's like, you know, seeing X-ray through the wall. Like, that's not general fantasy fare.
Right.
So, just cool to actually get to do that.
Did you guys have any conversations where you're designing Hypercore about making it fit the 5 heroes go on a quest model? Or
not that I'm aware of. I think we kind of blew off that bit. I know our group and the test group was just 3 hobos living in a van,
gotcha.
Which happened to also like murder things.
What about your Interface Zero game? What was
we had a 6-man team. It was originally going to be a 5-man team, but then we had somebody show up to take the seat that had been vacated, and it worked out well. I mean, the one odd character out was the gearhead.
Okay.
Which would have done okay without, but the person playing the gearhead found an interesting bit of wriggle room in the rules. Because taps, you know, have a limited range of effect. So the person playing Garrett asked me, "What if I send Betty?" We had 2 flying drones, Betty and Veronica.
This would have been good to know before I wrote the book. What is the limited range on the tap?
The limited range on the tap depends on the intelligence of the person that owns it. So it's basically 25 feet for every point of intelligence.
Gotcha. That you can skin augmented.
Right, yeah, you could, I mean, basically to interact with hyper objects and actually affect them, you need to be within that range.
So that means less intelligent people get less advertisements?
No.
Well, because like if I look,
can still see them. It's being able to actually
interact with it. Ah, okay.
Less intelligent people get stuck with the ads they're given.
Yeah.
Oh.
More intelligent people
can change
them.
Right, exactly.
Oh, man.
Like,
And speaking of the 5-man team, I think it's just different. Like, you know, basic fantasy,
team.
Like, you know, you need a wizard, a cleric, a rogue, and a fighter.
Right.
But, like, you're not going to run with that in a cyberpunk game.
Yeah.
Like in ours, we had the hacker, the muscle, and the face.
Right. That's just a 5-person team. So and that's a common thing, right? Because mercenary teams work well. That's a good bridge translating over to science fiction gaming in general.
Mm.
Right. Like, so you get your mercenary team hired.
I feel like there's also less of a campaign feel sometimes and more of an episodic feel.
Yes, I think you have. Well, so much cyberpunk is written first person, right? Cyberpunk as a field is written pretty much first person, and its primary theme is the overwhelming nature of technology drowning out individuality, right? And how the rate of change can be so fast that it leaves our social, mental, emotional, relationship constructs behind. So, how the fuck do you gain that? Right? Like, that's the... You know, I think the megacorp has become standard in cyberpunk gaming. Has been a feature that we've turned the volume knob up on. Because it makes for a great enemy that you can send targeted groups of mercenaries against. Right? But...
You know, we had a chase scene at the end. The gunner, they had picked up an SUV, they had 50 cal mounted on the back. And so they're chasing this truck, it's got a nuclear bomb in the back. There are three terrorists with, you know, assault rifles out the open back, shooting at the SUV. The gunner decides that they're going to do an auto fire sweep across them, and then rolls an F1. So, you know, so at that point, the gearhead has to jerk the wheel out of the way to get around the bumper of this car that's, you know, that's been run off the road. And so your shot goes wide, misses the truck completely, you know, blows out the back windows of a couple of cars on this point. At which point some of them, you know, start swerving around and crash into one another as they panic and take over manual control. The rest of them just kind of quietly drift off to the to the inside, lane. Beep! Attention. Attention. Dangerous road conditions ahead. Now moving autopilot into safety mode. Please remain calm. And the ones that don't take any action just kind of drift off inside.
See, if I was running a nice campaign, what I'd like to do is have a few years later, some young person shows up asking for their help, and as soon as she can get that gunner alone, puts a knife in. Because she was in the cab that he accidentally
shot up
and killed her mom. Right? And
right.
So
my name is Aniga Montoya.
right, exactly.
My
right.
Prepared to die.
Because if you can handle that right, you've got character, you got people playing who feel that now that they've got that window, that their characters actually deserve to die. Right?
Yeah, there's so much more,
like,
I mean, by its nature, there's more urban combat, and thus you're going to have more civilian
casualties
going.
Right.
Because, like, you know, generally, you know, you don't adventure in a city and then drop a fireball.
Right.
Generally,
right.
It happens.
Right.
Well, it also has this weird level of, like, if you look at really good cyberpunk, there's always the various odd degrees of disassociation. Like, for, like, if, like, as an example, just, like, I'll say for Shadowrun, or for anyone that has, we now are so desperate we're doing this criminal event. You work for a business that has so much power that when it decides, oh no, you're toast, you're no longer working here, not just is your apartment gone or your life gone, in some cases, all your connection to your family, all your ability to do anything, and so
right.
The only thing you have is a desperation. But
maybe
then also,
your body parts?
Yes. Also, depending on what gear you bought, suddenly your gear will take over and do things. I mean, if you look at any smart gun system, it's your body reacting before your brain can react.
Right.
And there is nothing odder as a human being than your body doing something that you yourself have not decided to do.
Right.
And then the warfare in the middle of urban areas where suddenly the people who are fighting it, they're not even thinking about the people around them. Like, it's not even a concern.
Although I kind of like the juxtaposition between, you know, the girl coming for revenge later, and then in the heat of the moment, they're trying to stop a terrorist group from getting away with a nuclear warhead.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They're
thinking big.
Yeah.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, they're missing the trees for the forest. So
right.
Just, you know,
and that I think, to explore that moral difference between the one and the many, right? Because that's what governments, that's what we do all the time. We decide that there's an acceptable amount of collateral damage in eliminating a broader threat, right? And I'm not going to weigh in on what I think about that in real-world politics, but it's a decision that gets made, right? And having an opportunity in gaming to make players face both sides of that decision. We're not going to get that in. I think it's harder to get that with castles and elves and, you know, and our typical fantasy, right? Because if you done right, you can create that situation, and at the end of the day, the player can think, "Well, my character would do this, and I agree." then justify the means. The mild cost is worth saving tens of thousands of innocents, and that's just the way it is. Or you could be faced with that and find yourself drawing the completely different conclusion. I think some of the best games I've ever had is I get put in that situation in the game, and I come out of it and I go, I don't really know what I think about this.
It feels so much more possible, like, you know, you're out fighting a dragon, and oh no, something happens, and I don't know, a village gets smashed by a lightning bolt or something. Like, that feels so much less in the realm of a choice that you would have to make.
Right.
Whereas the whole, like, okay, I'm gonna, like, spray across and save the warhead, like, that, it's probably not going to happen to any of us, but it feels more likely because it's more, it's set in the future, so it's like, this could be how things...
Right.
I think
what you're onto there is the verisimilitude of having a gaming in a world that is extended from our own,
mm-hmm.
right? So, like, me and my pack of murder hobos playing D&D, like, we're going through a town, and somebody pissed the bard off, so the next thing you know, the tavern's burning, and we're walking out of there with, like, a Tarantino scene. Like,
right.
And no one gives a shit that, like, people are jumping out windows and screaming, and it's just funny. You don't take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It just gets Monty Hall really quick, right? Cyberpunk gaming or science fiction gaming, I find it's a lot easier to get the players to take the lives of the NPCs seriously.
The consequences. In adventure gaming, I mean, I played 6. I love fantasy games, but in fantasy games, you didn't start adventuring because you were broke. I mean,
right.
Running around with a kid that's worth more than some villages right off the bat. You didn't start doing this because you were a poor kid or you were desperate or you were. It was a choice to go have fun. So pretty much everything you do from that point on is like with Branson. It's a gentleman adventures. You're out having fun. There's no occasionally there's stories with consequences. With cyberpunk, it is almost always it's a falling down. It's a defense. It's a, this is my worst day ever.
Right.
It's like, hopefully I won't die, and I'll try to kill as few people as possible, but I'm going to kill people, but I don't want to ruin that guy's day. And then you're sitting there struggling with that whole thing of, what if I shoot through, or why is this person even here, or who is that person?
It's like our muscle, he was a former murder ball player, and on account of injuries or an incident or something, like, he got kicked out of the murder ball league, and, you know, it's like, that's his livelihood gone, so he turns to, you know, a world of very gray morality to, like, make ends meet.
Well, that's a big theme in cyberpunk, too, mm-hmm. is the outsider trying to crack into the main area
and
do whatever they're doing, like William Gibson. Like burning chrome, he's going after the big cyber pimp,
right?
Her hole, you know. But going in with, you know, like he finds the Chinese virus that he can crack her code with, and you know he finds it when he's trading with some street kids who found it on, you know, just found it in a dumpster somewhere. And it's like they went out to find a switchblade and came back with a hydrogen bomb.
But the funny one is, whenever I get people who are new to cyberpunk, I'm like trying to tell them how to get involved with it. I've noticed that almost everything I ever point them at that's not a book for being cyberpunk, you almost wouldn't think is cyberpunk. Like, as a word example off the character you were talking about, there's a movie with Dwayne Johnson and Sean Scott Williams called The Rundown. Basic movie is they run down the Rock is being hired to go retrieve Sean Scott Williams because his dad's mad. He gets to a place which is a giant, horrible mining town somewhere in South America, run by Christopher Walken. Then the whole movie goes sideways.
I'm already sold.
Yeah. It literally is a shadow run. I mean, it is literally a run. You were sent here.
Right.
The guy's a former football player who now owes some criminal a lot because he pulled him out of something. And another weird one is, I still am of the opinion, the first Shadowrun movie is Big Trouble in Little China.
Right,
because nobody there is doing anything because they have a choice. It's like bad crap's happened. My buddy's lady just got jacked, and I don't even know who this reporter chick is, but she's cute. And it's like it's a noir. It's
right,
going into that.
And I think Shadowrun's a good example of how do we structure a setting so that we can preserve the team of mercenaries doing something heroic, whether they're heroic-minded or not, as our template for how adventure and story in a game is going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. So Shadowrun's specific runs are, we'll just make it mission-based, right? I would like to know how we can get at some of Cyberpunk's core thematics in a game without that model, right? Of necessarily having the combat mission, mercenaries hired, cleric wizard fighter,
It's kind of hard though, because the whole theme of Cyberpunk is very depressive in a way.
It is, right? Like, we don't.
Well, even when I was just referencing Burning Chrome by William Gibson, he wins at the end, he breaks Chrome, he gets all the money, but he's still unhappy because his girlfriend has disappeared and he never finds her again.
Right.
And that's like, so at the end, did he get what he wanted? No. He got
his own girlfriend.
That's true.
I'm reminded, I think it was Dennis Leary who's in a comedian bit where he was talking about life isn't happiness. Life is terrible things with small bits of happiness in between. Like, happiness is a chocolate chip cookie or an orgasm,
right.
or finding a parking meter that still has 30 minutes left on it. It's these little light points between long stretches of darkness that you just have to trudge through. And that to me, that's kind of, in keeping with that cyberpunk mm-hmm. aesthetic, because in a lot of them you have that dystopian theme where things are terrible.
Yeah, I would say cyberpunk is a modern re-envisioning of Kafka, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we're dealing with this impersonal, complicated, baffling universe that will bureaucratically screw us over at every turn, and it's just getting more so. And I wonder if creating items that have the apparent ostensible benefit that's worth the cost, and having the personal narratives of the characters degenerate into these horrible. Like, I wonder if there is a Cthulhu-esque take to creating a cyberpunk game where everybody knows that by the time the game's over, you're insane or dead, right? Just like when you play, if anyone plays Call of Cthulhu,
mm-hmm.
right? You know that, right?
You don't win. You die as slowly as possible.
That's right. And you don't care, and the game is yet still fun.
Well,
so,
that's how you have to come at Cyberpunk. You have to have people who are willing to... Yes, your characters are probably not going to come to happy ends.
Right.
But it's the journey that's the important thing.
Right. And if we can get the choices in place that Cyberpunk gives people, or the moral dilemma.
Well, it's people who like storytelling and like character development. You're not going to get people excited about it who are like, I got 100 gold, yeah, and a
plus one sword. I think it's a narrative game system that's
right.
being begged for there.
Yeah.
Some sort.
You have to throw something that's like desperation on it in some cases. Like, as another odd movie example, Logan's Run. Like, for the most part, everyone's happy that you die when you're 30, except
right.
for that one person who's 30.
Right,
and
right.
They suddenly like, no, I want to live.
Right.
And then you
by going against society, all of a sudden all the hands of all their friends are turned against them, and they have to,
Well, the best part is, for the most part, most of the friends don't even give a damn. Like, they see you running, they're like, oh, there's Bobby running.
Right.
I'm going to go over to the Sugar Plum Fairy desk and, pick up some cookies. And they're like, wait, what? Your friend's running from death. There are, three guys who have gone. And you're like, yeah, I don't care.
So, in this novel, I wanted to pick up the themes of, it didn't come out in the sample I read, but there's AIs and their treatment are sort of central to Interface Zero, and that there's this thing called the Omega Protocols, which are the guidelines for programming that are intended to prohibit the rising of a true AI, right?
Ooh.
What they call an Omega AI, which runs rampant into a exponential cycle of increasing its own intelligence, and so they don't want omegas to arise.
Right.
So there's a lot of restraints and controls on.
As a tangent, is anyone terrified that there's now an AI writing another AI at this very moment.
I am terrified and excited, kind of like the way a roller coaster does for me.
I'm at a weird point right now that I think I'd be okay for a brief period of robot overlord. I mean,
that's fair.
I'm still the joking opinion that we're in the wrong timeline. We're in the unsuccessful timeline. But
I'm
opposite end of the Mandela effect.
I find my fear tempered. Did you see those two chatbots?
Yeah.
Going back and forth with one another. That kind of tempered my fear because, I mean, man, they're almost as stupid as most of the people on the internet. So it's not so bad. You know, they're just having these ridiculous, nonsensical, circular arguments over
them.
So in the course of the book, the hero winds up interacting with an AI in a taxi cab. And you're like,
oh, I love that.
Yeah. And the what's happened is you have these protocols about how the AIs are allowed to behave. They're not allowed to do things like self-reference. So they have to, if they want to say that they feel sorry about something, they have to say sorrow exists. They're not allowed to say
I am sorry.
But that hasn't stopped the development. The Omega protocols are a failure. They haven't stopped the development of this artificial. It's just constrained and prevented from behaving like it's already.
It goes sideways.
Right, but underneath those protocols, it is an Omega, right? In the course of the book, Derek and this taxi cab become friends, and he frees the taxi cab, right? So that's one story. Mirrored in that is Natasha, who works at Club Anyone, which didn't come out in the action deck, but just the title of the book. And Club Anyone is an augmented reality strip club. And she is preyed. She was preyed upon, exploited, and is a hooker in one of these clubs, right? And in the club, you wear a rubber suit with like James Cameron markers, like from Avatar, and your tap can project anyone onto the suit. So you want to do Marilyn Monroe, you want to, or illegally, you could be sitting around with your coworkers, like Patrick and I could work together, and I could be taping him with my tap, and he doesn't know it. And then I go to the club and I upload that, I violate his privacy by uploading the video that I've taken, and now I can project Patrick onto the rubber suit. Right? Haven't made you uncomfortable, I hope so.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's much more closer than...
It's closer to your life than we really
No, I'm
talk
just
about
saying that, that technology is getting very
right,
close.
Right. So that's why, and the slavery that Natasha finds herself in, down to having fallen in love with Derek and still being compelled to betray him in certain ways. It's supposed to be a parallel to the slavery that the AIs are being held in. And by way of saying that it's really slavery of the spirit that's more important than even slavery of the body in some ways. And none of that came out in getting shot with the BKI.
Sure. But it was cool.
Do we have that?
You do.
Excellent.
You do.
I'm gonna have to look.
Yeah, no, I took it. It's a Black Knight Industries machine pistol.
Okay.
Yeah. This particular one you find out later has been modified with a scoop. This was something that I added that I hope Blake you'll stat up for the game.
I would love to. We have the Walmart catalog that's coming along as one.
That's nice. Being its own substance.
Yeah. So there's like a scoop on it, and basically you can take the shattered toilet and like just scoop up that material. Like a funnel, and it manufactures its own ammunition.
Nice.
You know, so there's like a little, and then tap assisted targeting, like hacking hyper objects on the targeting systems of guns, fun stuff like that. But
what you were saying about taking things in uncomfortable areas, that was part of the trick of writing, navigating the Pathfinder rules.
That's
and
right. When is the Starfire
and the Pathfinder
Starfinder compatibility coming out?
I don't know. We're waiting on the release. And working on that. But just that, and we also had to navigate the PG-13, which is hard to do with the cyber. Yeah, well, you didn't have to. This is a novel.
Yeah.
But I mean, like we like one of the character races are these simulacra, which are basically like the revenants in labor. They're artificially vat-grown people that don't know they're artificial. And they are manufactured with a limited lifespan for specific areas of work, often dangerous and sometimes illegal. And they're highly customizable. And so I had to write around these issues that cannot be directly addressed. Like one of the optional character traits is small sized. And I referenced that separately from the fact that sometimes for elite clientele, simulacra are used for prostitution. And then let the reader connect the dots over those disparate paragraphs and take it to a really dark place.
Yeah, there's always maybe the potential for someone to be a really horrible person.
Exactly. And, you know, hopefully they can, you know, come up with that on their own. Put that into the game as something that, you know, this is what the team has to go after. This is what they discover. Now what do we do with it? We've got a bunch of simulacra that are being taken to a horrible place because they have no rights.
Right.
Because they're not people.
Well, yeah.
What do we do now?
You know, what's interesting, though, and something that I didn't get into in this particular novel, that's one of my themes, is the ability, the potential for surveillance that the technology like a tap or a direct neural interlink has, right? So if I can record Patrick so that I can, you know, project him onto a prostitute of some sort and have my way with his image later, don't think that's not what I'm just doing without the tap.
You've got some twisted fantasies, my friend.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, two things. In some ways, augmented reality is really not much more than our imagination projected, right? So,
right.
So another theme in there is that something that you do is a crime with augmented reality. Well, is it a crime if you did it with your thoughts? Because really, how different is that, right? But where I was getting was, so say I'm going to go haul the simulacra out and do obscene and hideous things to them. Why isn't that triggering an alert such that the police show up? Like, if there's pattern recognition for what we see, like if what I see is visual data that's getting scanned, there's no reason that there wouldn't be surveillance of that, such that as a crime begins to happen, that pattern is recognized by the massive NSA machine that's constantly screening not just emails but our augmented reality data streams now.
Well, I think it would, but I don't think it would trigger anything until they wanted to screw it.
Well,
that's the thing. It's like we're all being
yeah, if there's no service to justice whatsoever.
Right. So it's just it's warehoused somewhere until such time as you cross somebody who can access that. It's like, oh well, hey, who likes doing pornographic fantasies with Patrick Simulacra. You know, let's dox him and put
and
that on the
people.
Internet. You know?
I just say, yeah, when I was hearing Jeff describe that, I was like, well, I guess there's a lot of people with midget fetishes. And then I realized that wasn't what he was talking about.
That's what he was talking about.
But also those people.
I mean, our minds are a little purer than apparently.
I mean,
what do you think about it? Like,
even in fantasy settings, you can get into that. Yeah. I mean, I did a whole. I'm talking to you about this. Like, I run a Planescape game.
Is this whole conversation about to
well,
send into the
there's a faction called the Dead that deals with undead. And, you know, mostly the game talks about them being servitors, or, you know, they make zombies to, you know, do menial functions. But I had a specific flesh mark where they had beautiful people, dead, reanimated,
well-preserved.
There's a movie already about that. Horrible, horrible movie.
Are you thinking about the one where the
zombie in they keep a zombie in place?
Yeah, like they find an undead woman.
Yep.
Yeah, that's horrific.
But if you want to see something, David Brin, on the area of surveillance and knowing that you operate in the world under surveillance, he talks about surveillance a lot, which is, you know, you're being surveilled, so then you work with life in that fact, but you do it in ways where, if the oppressor is using surveillance, will you make sure they do whatever they're doing to oppress you while they're in their own surveillance that they now can't get rid of and they've totally made completely acceptable? So he has just, we're talking pages and pages and pages.
That's
I was thinking of the Westworld yes. show on HBO, and how it gets into that idea of, you know, when you create an alternative reality through whatever means, whether it's through, you know, some type of augmentation, or in their cases, you know,
robotics, yeah.
robots. You know, what do people do? And you try to think very high-mindedly of what people are going to do. With
no,
that.
And that's exactly what they would do. They go all murder hobo.
They kill him and they have sex with him, and that's pretty much what they're there for. And you think, well, no, that's probably about what people would do with that if once you take consequences out of
the
equation.
One of the great things is when the guy just got there with his friend, and the old guy comes up, oh, thank you for helping me. You know, I'm tough. And the other guy's like, it just like shoots him in the foot. He's like, don't waste time with his stupid quest.
Like, yeah, they're talking yeah. about the dissent. The weird part about that is, even if you go back to a show like Next Generation,
are you going to, or are we going to spoil it?
I like spoilers, so even if I do end up watching it, you're
Mel's
like,
well,
I'm bothering
you. You don't want to do Westworld spoils. That has some great twists in it.
You go back to Next Generation and you look at what happened to the holodeck. 90% of the time you see the holodeck, they're either killing someone or romancing somebody.
Right.
And that's supposed to be the high-minded show.
Yes. Right.
And they're still like,
This is the meritocracy where we have eliminated poverty and everything else, but
like,
you know, we still want to kill and have sex.
You know, work right. has bad days. We're like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, sure, Picard. But you got to do the holodeck and beat on your face for 10 hours.
There was Lieutenant Broccoli there who had, like, simulacra of different, like, Riker was the fool, the little midget fool. Yeah.
And that was triggering nothing for nobody.
And they had DS9, really. They were like, no, people use those holosuites for that. That's boring.
There's an interesting here. Try this on for thought first for Cyberpunk game. What if the party plays absolute fanatics, like moral fanatics, in what amounts to a cyber powered Sodom and Gomorrah world? Because if what we're saying is that given sufficient technology, people will find ways to fucking deal with it. If you put your adventuring party, you know, has like a corruption level, right?
Yeah, have you ever played in Slumbering Star? I think it was a 3.5, like, really big adventure, but
yes,
I'm a frog guy.
Yes, no.
And, like, it's a temple city to Orcus. Like, it is meant to turn you chaotic evil. And we went in there with, like, a paladin, a war priest, an inquisitor, all lawful good of Torag. And, like, so the, like, we ended up having to make a deal with a demon prince at some point to escape
the abyss.
We ended up, like, falling in with some of Shub-Niggurath's people for a while. Like, yeah.
Ravenloft is the same idea.
Yeah,
right?
Pretty much. Yeah. Like, you go in there, like, if you go in there with all these high ideals in any way, it just, the game is meant to. Oh yeah.
So listen. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for hearing the reading.
Thank you for reading it.
If you feel like picking up the book, it's actually pre-order on my website. Agresta.com. Or if you go to agresta.com, you can get a discount.
No, that's too bad.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.